Senate Resources meeting of February 27th to order. Resource Committee members present, Senator Stevens, Senator Seekins, Senator Elton, Senator Kukesh, Senator Dyson, and myself, Senator Wagoner. Also with us is Senator French, Senator Guess, anybody, any other senators? I think we'll be joined by Senator Terrio shortly. So first, we won't take up the issue of the royalty reduction for the Ugugurik, I think I said that right, close to it anyway, field. Department of Natural Resources is not ready to do a model. Hopefully within the next few days they will be ready. And then they can do a comparison between the royalty reduction that took place and the what the PPT would do on that oil field. So today is the first hearing of the stakeholders meeting. Today we'll hear from ConocoPhillips. With us from ConocoPhillips is Brian Wenzel. He's the Vice President for Finance and Administration. Mary Ann Ka, their Chief Economist, and Darren Jones, the Vice President for Commercial Assets. And with that, we'll turn it over to Brian and
Chairman,
start off. We're all yours.
Chairman,
all yours.
Members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to come before you and present testimony on Senate Bill 305. It's a bill designed by the administration to replace the current production tax system. ConocoPhillips is proud of its 45-year-long history through ARCO and Phillips Petroleum Company here in Alaska. We have been actively exploring and developing oil and gas since the 50s, and we've been a producer for 49 years. ConocoPhillips is the state's leading oil producer, its leading explorer, its leading champion for gas for the gas pipeline. ConocoPhillips has also been the leading investor in Alaska. We are committed to Alaska, and this year alone are reinvesting over $700 million in Alaska capital projects, to those in our core legacy fields, but also bringing on new developments. Over the past 10 years, we've invested over $5.8 billion in capital and another $6.8 billion in expense here in the state. We are among the state's largest employers of Alaskans, and we pay more than any other entity, a total of $1.6 billion to the state of Alaska in royalty and taxes. We can't talk about ConocoPhillips in Alaska without talking about our employees. We have approximately 1,000 employees in the state, and approximately 90% of them are Alaskan residents and proud of it. They are competent, motivated, and active in the communities where they live and where we operate. They care about Alaska, and they believe that the work they do makes Alaska a better place to live. They see themselves as playing an important role in building the future of Alaska. And through the contractors, subcontractors, and support industries, we directly and indirectly generate employment for thousands of additional Alaskans. The past, present, and future of ConocoPhillips and the state of Alaska are inextricably linked. As we move forward as partners for perhaps the next 50 to 100 years, we believe there must be a mutual recognition of and respect for the interests of each of us. We have to try together to answer the question, how do we balance the factors that affect each of our interests in a way that makes us both successful, so that we have, over time, we are both better off than if we had single-mindedly tried to pursue our own individual short-term interests. This is the balance that the governor's bill tries to strike. Unfortunately, that balance in that bill is decidedly in the favor of the state and at the expense of established investors like ConocoPhillips. We believe the governor's bill sets an aggressive level of state take when take is considered in conjunction with our other corporate income tax obligations to the state, our property tax obligations to the state, our property and sales and other tax obligations to the state's municipalities, our royalty obligations to the state, and the various oil and gas surcharges imposed by the state and sundry additional fees and costs that apply in the permitting process whenever we move forward with some of our developments. All of which, of course, is on top of our corporate income tax obligations to the federal government. It is no surprise that this layer upon layer of governmental take inevitably has a negative impact on the level of investment here in Alaska, and commensurately a negative impact on the level of job creation and job growth in the state. As taxes increase, It is difficult to see how investment in Alaska will not be affected. On the other hand, we realize the legislature cannot adopt a tax policy that is concerned exclusively with maximizing the robustness of the state's economy and the participants in that economy. The government is charged with providing certain essential government services to its citizens, and those essential services cost money. And if the state cannot pay or chooses not to pay for those services from the proceeds of the sale of its resources, that is, the royalty proceeds from its oil and gas, then that state must turn to its sovereign taxing power to obtain the revenues necessary to pay for those services. While we support the passage of this bill, we do so reluctantly. The bill reflects a significant tax increase on our company and on the industry at a time when the government is enjoying a large budget surplus. We believe the tax rate set in this bill is too high to guarantee the state's goal of increasing investment over the long term, and it punishes companies who have made long-term investments and are returning dividends to the state in the form of jobs, royalties, corporate income taxes, and property taxes. We would, in fact, oppose this bill, except for the fact that it has enabled all parties to come together in support of a contract under the Stranded Gas Development Act. That act will move the gas pipeline to the next phase of development. Try that agreement. Advancing the gas pipeline has been and continues to be one of ConocoPhillips' top priorities. With that introduction, I'd like to start off by discussing some of ConocoPhillips' long-term investments in Alaska and the role they have played in minimizing North Slope production decline and the impact that ELF has had on those developments. As I mentioned, ConocoPhillips is Alaska's leading producer and explorer. Since 1989, we've been involved with the exploration and development of 14 satellites. You can see those come on the screen here. And those satellites have then resulted in new production on the North Slope, which is the blue wedge above the expectations back in 1989, which is the purple wedge below. These satellites were predominantly marginal developments, the 50 to 150 million barrel type that the state is targeting with this legislation, and they were able to be developed as a result of the favorable fiscal treatment given under ELF. Development of these satellites played a significant role in reducing North Slope decline and enabling more than 1.9 billion barrels of additional oil to be produced compared to the predictions back in 1989. This is equivalent to discovering a Kuparuk-sized field and has added more than $5 billion in revenues to the state of Alaska. In addition to our active satellite developments, we continue to actively explore and drill we've drilled more than 40 exploration and appraisal wells in the last 5 years. We are committed to continuing to explore in the state and developing future successes. As we look back in general, the ELF structure did what it was intended to do and enabled ConocoPhillips to continue exploration, pursue heavy oil, develop marginal satellite fields, and maintain infield drilling. It increased the barrels in the pipeline, and the state government was able to collect royalties, corporate income taxes, property taxes, and various fees and surcharges that go along with these developments. The federal government collected its share, but most important, Alaska's economy was able to grow. We understand the state's view on the limitations of the current ELF-based severance tax system, particularly at high prices. We also understand that there's no such thing as a perfect tax system. However, we believe that there can be such a thing as a wise and enduring tax policy. We believe a production tax, such as the governor has proposed, that's intended to reflect profits from that production, include incentives to encourage investment in the future, and a fair transition provisions that recognize the costs of investments already made, is such a policy. Nevertheless, Senate Bill 305, as proposed, will result in an average $1 billion per year in additional state revenue at today's prices. Even with significant industry levels, this unprecedented increase will more than double the existing severance tax payments. This chart that I have up now shows the blue line on the bottom represents our expectation of state of Alaska revenues under the ELF system. The red line on top is our projection for the revenues received under the new PPT system with the 20% base rate and 20% tax credits. And the blue bars on the bottom simply represent the incremental difference between the two lines. With that backdrop, Marianne and I would like to give you ConocoPhillips' perspective on several key areas. We'll talk more about each of these, but first, our view is that a balanced fiscal structure is both is critical to both oil and gas future investment. Secondly, the future of oil production in Alaska is primarily dependent on existing fields. Senate Bill 305 differentially and adversely impacts our legacy production from existing fields, as we'll show you. Fourth, a significant transition plan is necessary to allow an equitable conversion from the old tax system to the new tax system. And fifth, the new PPT will impact Alaska's global competitiveness for investment. And we'll ask Mary Ann to speak to you about that. In terms of a balanced fiscal structure and our perspective there, there have been many questions about the relationship of the governor's oil tax proposal to the fiscal contract negotiations under the Stranded Gas Development Act. As you know, the fundamental purpose of the Stranded Gas Development Act was to encourage new investment and to develop the state's stranded gas resources by establishing fiscal terms in advance with as much certainty as the Constitution of the state of Alaska allows. Unfortunately, the line between oil and gas is not clear-cut. Oil and gas exist together in reservoirs. The wells we drill produce them both. Many of the investments necessary to develop gas will also develop oil. Ultimately, this means that the fiscal certainty provided by the state under the Stranded Gas Development Act will be inadequate if only applied to gas. The administration has recognized the need for the legislature to approve any agreement that included fiscal certainty for oil, but that administration was unwilling to consider fiscal certainty for oil under the terms of the current production tax statute. It was, instead, willing to propose to the legislature a new oil tax that's before you that could become part of a fair and durable fiscal regime for both oil and gas. But the administration's position has been clear. The new production tax has to stand on its own. In other words, it had to represent something that the legislature itself would accept as wise tax policy in the absence of the deal on the natural gas pipeline. For our part, this oil tax increase, an average of $1 billion for the industry at today's prices, is not something that ConocoPhillips would have found acceptable if we didn't think it would progress and ultimately result in an agreement to move forward on the gas pipeline project. So once again, the proposed oil tax increase by the administration is a balance. On the one hand, it provides a foundation for fiscal stability for the oil and gas-related businesses of the producers in Alaska. This stability is essential to the future investment, including investment in development and the development of the gas pipeline project. On the other hand, the producers must pay substantially more in taxes than they would under the current regime. I would like now to move on briefly and talk about the future of oil production in Alaska. Even with the proposed incentives, the state's consultant has acknowledged that production resulting from wildcat exploration will only play a small role in increasing revenues under the PPT. The core legacy fields, such as Prudhoe and Kuparuk, would still produce over 80% of the total North Slope production in 2015. Providing that the base infrastructure on these smaller fields will depend. The already discovered heavy oil resource will play a much more significant role in the future of the North Slope. However, the state's consultant acknowledged that technology limitations and development costs will constrain heavy oil in the near term, and it could be many years before this production reaches its potential. Yet this heavy oil resource base is huge, and published data suggests that in-place volumes are greater than 20 billion barrels. This is a key resource for Alaska, and the legislature should consider a structure that would best enable its development. On this chart, you can see the production profile for the existing fields and known resources in the yellow bars on the bottom. You can see known discoveries expected to produce additional incremental production in the future starting in 2008. The heavy oil stack bars in blue represent the heavy oil that can be produced with today's technology. But again, much of that 20 billion barrels of heavy oil that's out there as resource potential, we do not yet have the technology to extract that resource. And finally, the wildcat exploration is shown there on the top. And just for perspective, help everyone understand what the state's expectation is in terms of incremental production from these sources in the future. This slide looks at the heavy oil resource. And again, more than 20 billion barrels over on the left-hand side. If you jump all the way to the right-hand side, we can show you that of the 15 billion barrels that exist in the Kuparuk River unit area, only the small slivers down on the very bottom of that right-hand side are, we believe, extractable with today's technology. In fact, the the bottom slice there, the existing 1C and 1D is current production. We have 1E and 1J projects in development now, and we think we can use the technology and the learnings from those developments to actually incrementally develop some additional volumes there in the purple. But again, the large slice there above that in red is resource that we can't tap right now, given the technology we have. And consequently, the technology required to develop this resource requires huge expenditures. Therefore, heavy oil should be given differential consideration in the form of either a lower tax rate or additional tax credits to develop. The bill has been designed to encourage new investors to come to Alaska. We fully support the arrival of new players and believe they can be beneficial to both the state and the industry. Indeed, we already have made partners of several of them. However, the terms that will attract new investors also come with a cost. Under the governor's proposal, the tax increase mainly targets our legacy production assets, Prudhoe and Kupar, and will result in one of the highest, if not the highest, severance tax burden anywhere in the United States. This is an unprecedented fiscal increase for those who invested tens of billions of dollars to develop the North Slope and stayed in Alaska through difficult times, including periods of very low prices. We believe that such an increase could undermine investor confidence in Alaska. On the slide that I have up now, this is a slide looking at effective tax rates, so all based as a denominator on revenue. If you look at across the x-axis on the bottom to a $60 price and read up to the ELF line, the red line, you can see the effective tax rate now around 7%. But the brown line above that, the solid brown line, represents the effective tax rate under the new PPT system. You can see it's easily double what the effective tax rate is under the current ELF system. And the two dashed lines, one above and one below, represent the effective tax rates, again, over this 20-year period of our legacy, core legacy assets versus satellites and new developments. Because 65% of the North Slope production over the next 20 years is expected to come from those legacy assets, those known resources, you can see why we're not happy with the fact that those known resources, those core assets, pay a higher effective tax rate under the new system. As we have discussed, the huge rate increase reflected in this bill is something that ConocoPhillips supports with great reluctance. We should acknowledge that the state is currently enjoying a budget surplus, and if one were to consider moving to a profits tax that collected the same amount that is collected today under the current law, the ELF-based system, the PPT rate for that equivalent system would only be 13% as opposed to the 20% that's in this bill today. Nevertheless, the legislature has fielded many questions over the last week, some of which would suggest the tax rate of 20% is too low, and that 25% would be more appropriate. Anytime the government raises taxes, it's taking away money from the private sector that could be used for investment and continued job growth. While it is obvious that higher taxes would negatively impact the oil and gas industry, we also believe those higher taxes, those higher rates, would not be in the long-term best interest of the state. New field sizes in Alaska are small. Arctic operating and development costs are high. We therefore spend a lot more time and resources assessing upside potential and downside risk. When we invest, we do so, we fully understand that there's a chance that we may not get the return on investment that we expect, but we also acknowledge that results could exceed our expectations. Hopefully we are right more than we are wrong. But as we bear the greatest risk, it is fair that we should be appropriately rewarded. We acknowledge that the presence of tax credits reduces downside for the investors, but conversely, higher tax rates significantly reduce the upside potential, which is a prime driver in our investment outlook. To attract investors, the state needs to set an appropriate risk-reward balance. If the credits are too high, the state will take too much downside risk. If the tax rate is too high, the investors see insufficient upside potential and look for better opportunities elsewhere. As we have mentioned before, with a high field cost, the limited exploration prospectivity, investors in Alaska need upside potential. Moving towards a 20% will seriously disrupt this risk-reward balance. Getting the right balance between the tax rate and the credits for reinvestment is critical to the future resource development in Alaska. The balance that is provided in this bill, while incorporating a significant tax increase, reflects, as we've said, a balance that we are willing to reluctantly accept. Changes, even small ones, will impact this balance and will cause investors to reevaluate potential investments. 20% as a base tax rate can be implemented, But the question you have to ask yourself and wrestle with as a legislature is, with a tax rate that high, are you really going to get the type of long-term and the level of long-term investment that you desire? I'd like to move on and talk about our views on the transitional investment expenditure plan that's incorporated in the bill. This is the plan that looks back at historical investment. Under the bill, a fraction of the producer's expenditures for exploration, appraisal, and development capital incurred over the past 5 years may be deducted for purposes of calculating the producer's monthly profit tax obligation. ConocoPhillips supports this plan as it provides an equitable transition to the new tax system and is an essential piece of the overall balance reflected in this bill. I'd like to give an example now of the Fuard Field, which was discovered back in 1992, prior to discovery of the Alpine Field. It was not possible to develop this small field by itself, and it's only with the expansion of the Alpine facilities in 2004 that it is now possible to develop the satellite. The project kicked off in 2003 when faced with the ELF aggregation and was in jeopardy of not moving forward in 2005. The Department of Revenue provided ConocoPhillips with a letter ruling stating that Fjord would be treated as a standalone satellite and not be aggregated with Alpine for severance tax purposes. As a small satellite, Fjord would have a low ELF and hence pay little severance tax. Once this decision was received from the Department of Revenue, ConocoPhillips and its partners sanctioned the project and moved forward. Fjord will be an 18-well roadless satellite with first production in late third or fourth quarter this year. Drilling will continue in 2007 and 8. Production will peak at 17,000 barrels per day coming in 2007-2008. Total capital costs on this project are expected to be around $300 million. While oil and gas prices have significantly increased over the last few years, we're also seeing dramatically increased labor and material costs. On this project alone, we expect the cost to be $30 million more than originally sanctioned. The majority of costs associated with developing the Fjord project will have been expended prior to the bill becoming effective. Without the transitional investment expenditure plan, only costs associated with 2007 and 2008 winter drilling programs would be eligible for the PPT. As previously discussed, the project was sanctioned based on the letter ruling from the Department of Revenue, assuming the field would pay full state corporate income tax, full royalty, property tax, but little or no severance tax. However, under this new bill, the development would now be subject to a 20% PPT rate. Without the transition plan, the increase in the fiscal terms will result in a reduction of $100 million in the gross value of this project and a 6% reduction in our average return at a $40 ANS West Coast price. ConocoPhillips is currently working on two other satellites in addition to Fjord. These are Nanook, due to start up in 2006, and WestSat-1J, which came online late 2005. All of these projects will have similar value loss impacts and without the transition plan. In addition, there are several other projects undertaken in the last few years which are now almost fully developed and will have value eroded as a result of the PPT. But our view is in order to ensure these past investments are equitably treated, the transition plan is essential. I would now like to ask Marianne Kaa, again our chief economist from ConocoPhillips, to spend a few moments discussing how this proposed tax change might impact Alaska's competitiveness and from the perspective of a global investor. Marianne?
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Marianne Kaa, the chief economist from ConocoPhillips. I'm also part of the corporate planning department in Houston at our headquarters. So I was hoping to give you a perspective on how we would view different investments around the world and sort of characteristics we look for in terms of the risk-reward trade-off. And maybe this will give you some insight into what investors are looking for in terms of tax rates. First, let me say that I really appreciate the difficulty of your position. Many factors have to be considered by a government in choosing an appropriate tax rate for an industry as complex as ours. The cost structure, the prospectivity of the field, the potential field size, reservoir quality, regulatory constraints, and the desired level of investment are perhaps but just a few of the factors that need to be considered. And these factors interrelate and are not always obvious how they relate to each other or how to predict them. Nevertheless, I want to discuss several of them and try to give you information that I hope is going to be helpful. With that said, let me turn to my first slide. This slide shows for Alaska and other locations around the world the average capital and operating costs over the last decade. It does not include exploration or appraisal. It does include the TAPS tariff, but it does not include additional costs for Alaska to reflect the high cost of the polar tankers, Jones Act tankers. But even without those costs, you can see that Alaska has higher capital and operating costs than other regions we invest in. And cost needs to be taken into account when we set the tax take. The countries with the lowest costs can afford to have higher tax rates while remaining competitive. And similarly, higher cost countries need to offset these conditions with lower tax takes. If I can go to the next slide. Don't be alarmed by the slide. It looks complicated, but it really is quite simple. What you're seeing here is total costs along the x-axis on the bottom, going from the lowest to highest. And on the left y-axis, you're seeing the percent government take of revenues. So this puts all tax structures on the same basis as a percent of revenues. And what you're seeing here is those lines are showing you that as cost goes up, tax take goes down. That's why the lines are curving down the way they are. But there are different regimes. There's a lower tax set of countries that are usually net importing countries, like the United States would be one of them, where we're trying to maximize our domestic production, so we generally have lower tax rates than other countries in the world. On the high side, you have countries like Norway or the big producers in the Middle East who are net exporting countries. They're getting so much from their exports that they're not as concerned about having as low a tax rate or getting as much investment. But let me explain the quadrants. The most competitive quadrant up here is the gray on the bottom, the low-cost, low-tax quadrant. They are not trying to offset their lower costs and take a higher tax rate. They're trying to remain very competitive. The Gulf of Mexico is an example. The UK is almost in that quadrant, but a lot of U.S. states would be in that quadrant.
But in the Gulf of Mexico, what taxes do you have there for the most part?
Isn't
the reason the Gulf of Mexico is so profitable is there's hardly any federal taxes, there are no state taxes. So that, you know, in all reality, that should be in the low
yes, Mr. Chairman. And that was the intent, to get people to come and invest there so we'd slow down the decline in U.S. production. I think that was the intent of the federal legislators, to make it economic to come into the Gulf.
Is it not, in fact, the case that the federal government is taking a real hard look at the Gulf of Mexico and that area to see if they shouldn't be leveling some fairly substantial increased taxes on it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would argue the only reason why it's being looked at again is because prices are high now. If prices were $30 or $40 today, I doubt that they would be having that discussion. Mm-hmm. And when prices do come back down, which we all expect, that I would expect that discussion to go away. So I consider it's a concern to me, which I'll talk about later, that just because prices are high, governments are talking about changing tax structures. That's a more general concern that companies have today, which I will address more later.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe I was distracted, but the government take on the left side there, vertical, that's a percentage of what?
Of revenues.
Of revenues?
Yes.
And so does that chart say that under the ELF that the government take is 60% of revenues?
Yes, it does, sir. That includes state and federal, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dyson. I haven't even gotten to that part of the chart. I was explaining the general overview.
And under the PPT, it would go up to what, 67 and change?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dyson.
So it's actually a 10% delta?
Well, the state's consultant said it was a 6% increase, but I think our own numbers said it was slightly higher. They didn't have the right royalty number, I think we thought.
Okay, thank you.
But you've gotten me to that quadrant, and that's the point I wanted to make. The low-cost, low-tax quadrant, these are clearly places that are trying to make themselves very competitive. You go up to the low-cost, high-tax, they have a higher tax because they have a low cost, they could attract companies to invest. If you go down to the lower quadrant in the right corner, the high-cost, low-tax, there they have lower tax rates because they do have higher costs and need to offset that factor. And then the last gray region on the top right is the high cost, high tax. And there you're not getting as much investment because they're not trying to offset their higher cost with a lower tax rate. And Norway would be an example of a country in that category.
Senator Alton.
First of all, I want to make sure that I'm clear on something, Marianne. I mean, are you counting royalty as part of the tax structure here? And if so, why? I mean, the royalty reflects that it's our oil, and that's part of the lease condition.
Mr. Chairman, I believe royalties are in this number, but when we're trying to show it the way an investor would look at it, and, you know, the dollars are dollars.
And then the second question, Marianne, I mean, I get it, you know, even with four quadrants and different lines and different price points here, I get all of that. But one of the things that has consistently bothered me is it's very easy to chart on something like this what the cost may be. But it doesn't show me anything about what the risk to you may be. For example, I mean, I would assume that you don't have to worry about your employees because you're working in Alaska as you would if you were in Nigeria. You don't have to build compounds in Alaska like you do in Saudi Arabia. I mean, how do you factor those risks into an investment scenario?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Alton, we do in fact take those costs into risk, and you're sort of beating me to the punch. I was going to get to the fact that when it comes to political risk, we view Alaska very favorably, which is why we've been here so many years. So yes, we definitely take that into account. But all I'm saying is you need to take into account the cost, the prospectivity, and the political risk, and look at all of these factors, not several in isolation. I'm just taking one at a time. But later on, I was going to say that one of the reasons why we've invested in Alaska all these years is because we like the risk structure.
Okay. And you have a chart for that, then?
I don't have a chart because there's no numbers to show, although there are people who actually do political risk ratings. But my concern is that political risk, our view of political risk, even in the United States, is going up because we hear talk about windfall profits tax and all these things. That's actually changing our view of the political risk in what traditionally we have thought as extremely low-risk country. But my only point here was really on cost and the reverse relationship and how Alaskan Elk was on the sort of the middle road line. And moving up to the PPT structure does take it into that higher cost, higher tax quadrant. Granted, this is only one factor, and I'm about to talk about several other factors. But that is one thing that we do take into consideration.
Senator Sequins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I see what you say. This isn't tax, this is government take.
Yes.
For all, it's federal, state, royalty, it's take. So what you're looking at as an investor is how much of this dollar is left over for me to pay not only for profit, but to pay for my capital investment and everything else. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Sequins.
So now my only question is the slice of time that you're looking at there is 2004. And as I understand it,
it's the last 10 years
over a period of 94 through 2003.
Right.
Now, did you look at that because that is some indication of what you think the cost of oil is going to be in terms of it, or just in terms of, or did you just use that because that's the latest numbers you have that you could look at from that standpoint?
Right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Sequins, we looked at that because Wood Mackenzie did a study in 2004 where they looked at every tax regime in the world. So we had very good data for that tax regime.
So other than the PPT, the rest of it reflects data from the Wood Mackenzie report.
That's exactly correct.
Okay, thank you. That's what I need to know.
Senator Terrio.
Thank you. Just regarding the discussion, and you said you're going to get into this a little bit later, the tax system, like the federal government system, it doesn't have price progressivity. And thus, in the past, we've considered, and there have been windfall profits tax. There's some talk about that back in D.C. now. There's agitation at the high prices in the Gulf. The federal government's not getting its share. There's pressure from the state governments to get its share. It seems to me if we're contemplating going to a different system, that we want to be able to incorporate a wide variety of prices so that the tax system itself, as price moves up and down, doesn't lead to destabilization. And in fact, our consultant has indicated that one of the things that's a number of countries around the world who did plan ahead and had progressivity into their formula, they're not contemplating changes now. And anytime you contemplate a change, is it going to change? At what rate is it going to change? That's destabilizing. Right. So we should be moving to a system that has some progressivity to it with regard to price, so that we can get that long-term stability, or better chance at long-term stability, even if it's not locked in to the, under the terms of a contract. I'm wondering if you can make some comments on that. And it's my understanding that in the back and forth between the administration and the companies, there was a proposal by the companies that did have a degree of progressivity to it. Might have quibbled about where the starting point was, but it did reflect an upward take for government as prices moved up.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we really would be perfectly happy with a progressive price structure. Our issue really is the overall take level and the fairness in terms of the investments we've made over the last 5 to 10 years, expecting a certain risk payout that would suddenly be taken away. But in terms of, you know, moving to a better system, you know, we'd be happy to have Alaska move to what they thought was a fairer and better system, as long as we were treated fairly in the process.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I find that there's one part of that slide that we haven't talked about yet, and that is the fact that regardless of whether the difference between ELF and PPT, I only see three regions under the study that have a higher cost structure than we do, and that nothing has changed in terms of the cost structure. I see one's a Canadian Arctic. What are the other two? Do you know?
I think
that out. The lower right is,
yes,
one
the lower right is Eastern Canada, like Hibernia.
Eastern Canada, and then what's the one that, the one on the all the way to the
Morocco? All, we hear someone whispering in my ear that it's Morocco.
Morocco? Morocco's all the way on the right vertical. Eastern Canada and Morocco. And of all the, obviously some of us have studied portions of Wood Mackenzie, all of it. So there's only three areas in the global production that have higher cost structure than we do.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is correct. In terms of Wood Mackenzie's study, which does include most of the producing countries, it's the Arctic conditions, it's the transportation costs as well.
Thank you.
Now, I don't believe they include Russia on there. And Russia is, and Arctic Russia in particular, would be equally high cost.
Further question? Okay, thank you.
Okay. So my real point on this slide was to show that Alaska under ELF is in sort of the middle of the road position, and it has moved up into that high cost, high tax quadrant with the overall tax take level of the PPT. And it's interesting to note that peer areas such as the Gulf of Mexico and the UK North Sea, even if you'd adjusted for recent tax increases, are still significantly more favorable regimes. The high cost in the Arctic and the types of fields that are likely to be found suggest that the proposed fiscal regimes could detract rather than encourage significant investment. If I can go to the next slide, I now want to talk about commercial discovery size, or what we think of as prospectivity. This is showing you the average commercial discovery size in Alaska versus various countries around the world over the last decade. And areas with high prospectivity can generally assess higher tax rates while maintaining investment. The Alaska North Slope, however, has limited prospectivity as compared to these other parts of the world that we are exploring in, and we believe the tax rates should reflect that. The state's consultant assessed the competitiveness of Alaska's tax rates by comparing these different regimes around the world based on similar field sizes. And I would like to point out that that is not the way investors look at it. When we would compare, for example, an investment in Russia versus Alaska, we're comparing the prospects of for example, a 750 million barrel field, like the YK field we're considering in Arctic Russia right now, versus maybe a 50 to 100 million barrel field that we might find in Alaska. So you really can't compare fields with the same size. You have to take into account the higher prospectivity in terms of the tax rates that that project will be able to support. And the greater prospectivity in Russia may compensate for the higher tax rates. When you add political risk in, you know, it may change that picture, but I think you need to take that higher prospectivity into account. Thus, I also want to point out that it's not really meaningful to compare the competitiveness of Alaskan tax terms with Russia, Azerbaijan, and Angola at similar field sizes. It's just not a meaningful comparison. Now, I want to talk about Norway specifically because the state's consultant has stated that Norway is comparable to Alaska, both in its wealth of natural resources and its cost structure, and it should be an analog for Alaska. But I don't believe it's a good one because Norway does, in fact, have a lower cost structure and better prospectivity. However, Norway does have significantly higher taxes than Alaska. I don't believe this model is helpful to you because, as shown on this slide, crude production in Norway has declined 17% since 2001, and that's in a fairly high price environment. So I know the Norwegian Energy Ministry is very concerned about this. Also, I would say that Norway is not getting enough investment since its tax regime isn't in line with its cost and prospectivity position. Next slide I would like to show looks at petroleum industry reinvestment rates. Investors need stable fiscal terms with tax rates that are commensurate with the cost structure and the size of the opportunity. Alaska's tax regime has offered that in the past. And that is why we have found Alaska to be such an attractive place to invest. But with the recent tax increases we have seen in locations around the world, I'm really becoming concerned that global tax takes are reaching a point where private companies are finding it challenging to invest. And I believe one of the main reasons why these reinvestment rates in the green bars have not moved up with the oil price, and this is true, this is the independence, all the entire industry is reflected in that chart, is because there hasn't been the tax rates are reaching a point that we're not finding enough investments that are attractive and meet our shareholder returns. Now, there are several other reasons in terms of fairness. We expect prices are going to cycle down to more normal levels, so we're not going to invest, assuming that prices stay at this high level. And there's also a lag time in developing projects, so there will, in some degree, be a delayed supply response. But I believe that tax rates around the world are also playing a key role. I also believe reinvestment rates are lagging because we're worried that we will make investments and governments will change their tax rates afterwards. So longer term, I'm concerned that private oil companies are being pushed out of the conventional oil business. We're going to be forced to invest in alternative energy supplies and things that have more favorable tax terms. And this is why someone has come up from the corporate office. I really wanted to share that concern with you.
You know, I'll just ask you a question. I realize you're going to look at this conservatively on oil prices. And I'm not going to say who, but I know a gentleman owes me a good bottle of wine because I made him bet that oil prices wouldn't move much off of $60 for the next 6 months, and it's been about a year and a half, 2 years since we made that bet. So how conservative are the companies, and I don't mean just you, but overall, how conservative are the companies going to stay in their projections on crude oil prices, taking that into account? Because I didn't know whether it was a good bet I was making or not. I thought I was, I'd read a couple articles, I thought it was a pretty good bet, but I could have been wrong.
Well, congratulations, Mr. Chairman. You can certainly replace me any time in our company. I have long since given up trying to forecast oil prices. But in all seriousness, I mean, there are several factors that suggest that prices are exaggerated today. The first is we had extraordinary global economic growth and demand growth in 2004, which is not being repeated. It's starting to come down. China had unusual factors. They had a power shortage and were using diesel generators, and like an extra 300,000 barrels a day of demand in China in 2004 that's now gone. We are also now seeing a price response to the higher prices, and it's showing up in demand growth. For example, 2005 had a demand growth rate that was under the 10-year average. I estimate that we lost about 1 million barrels a day of demand growth in 2005 because of the higher price environment. Another reason why I think prices are staying where they are is a lot of financial investors are moving money in paper markets out of the equities and out of bonds and into the commodities, including oil. So I believe that money is overwhelming our oil markets now and keeping the forward price curve at a very elevated level out 5 years. We've never seen them invest 5 years out in the curve before. They can come out. This is cyclical.
I understand what you're saying about China in one case, but in the other case, I was just in China in September. They're building a tremendous amount of new roads. They're getting ready to produce their own automobiles. They're back where we were probably in the 1920s, and they're getting ready to get rid of all their bicycles, and everybody with an income and allowance is going to have a car. So that if that does take a dip, I would say it's not going to dip very long.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would agree with you, and I'm actually very bullish on China myself. So I believe that prices will come down, but I also don't believe they're going back to the $20 we have seen historically. They're coming back down to a higher level, partly because of the China factor in developing Asia, India as well.
Senator Elton.
On that, thanks, Mr. Chair. On that point, Marianne, I think I understand what you're saying, and I'm maybe getting a little bit of cognitive dissonance, because if you go back to, you don't have to go back, but slide six, it shows the state of Alaska nominal take at $60 a barrel. I mean, so it seems to me that what you're doing here is you're saying, don't count on, you know, these high prices. They're
right.
Being artificially held up. I think you also said that you assume prices will cycle down. Where will they cycle down to, and why doesn't slide six reflect what the price that you think it will be out in the future instead of at the $60 level?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, as I said before, you know, I have been following oil prices for 25 years, and I don't even try to forecast anymore. We look at different scenarios, and we look at our projects through a range of prices, because the truth is we don't know whether they're going to be $30 or $50 a barrel. I'm pretty sure they're not going to be, you know, $60, but we really don't know. And I think the industry has to have the most conservative view on this, as the state should, because we're the ones making the investments. You know, the consultants and the financial Wall Street analysts can say anything they want, but we're the ones who have to take that risk. So we will always have a more conservative view than people who are not putting their money where their mouth is and investing those dollars. I will tell you this, though, the financial community consensus today appears to be about $40 a barrel when I look at the various analysts. There are some outliers. The other thing I want to make sure you're aware of is that when people talk about price, they need to talk about cost. Our cost structure is really high today. In fact, Goldman Sachs actually believes replacement costs today are $50 a barrel. And I can believe it. Drilling costs, steel costs, everything has gone up. This is cyclical. The service industry has not kept pace with our spending level. And eventually, I think they will make the investment and the costs will come down. But people think there's a big windfall taking place when, in fact, a lot of it is being absorbed by higher costs.
Mr. Chair, I would just and Conoco may wish to do it, or the State Department of Revenue may wish to do it. But when you've got a slide six that shows the state's nominal take out to the year 2025 at $60 an oil, I think it would be helpful to have in our packet the same graph at $40 a barrel oil, if in fact that's what you're making your decisions based upon.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, I did not say that's how we're making our decisions. I said we're more conservative than the financial community. And that's all I can say. This is really competitively sensitive information. We wouldn't want our competitors hearing how we base our decisions, because we bid against them in auctions around the world.
It sounds to me like maybe we need to ask the Department of Revenue for that, Chair.
So moving on. Another concern that we have from a major company's point of view, which is another reason why I'm here, is I sense that there's a bias in the proposed tax regime in favor of new versus the legacy investors. And I believe there's a common misperception that smaller and medium-sized petroleum companies have lower return requirements than the majors. As an economist, I'd like to point out that they have a higher cost of capital than we do. It's because they're less diversified, and therefore they have they're viewed as being more risky, both by the bond community and the equity investors. So they have a higher cost of capital, and therefore should have higher return requirements than we do. And companies that don't invest and return sufficient adequate returns to their shareholders are no longer with us today. So I don't think you want companies to come in here who aren't going to invest conservatively and return sufficient money to their shareholders. And I would imagine, and I don't want to speak for the independents, but I would imagine that they would be comparing Alaska's tax regime to the Gulf of Mexico, the United Kingdom, Canadian oil sands. Those are common areas where they've been frequent investors. But the state's consultant concluded that tax rates in these locations were more competitive than existing and proposed tax rates in Alaska. And what I worry about, if countries decide that they're going to have high taxes today, it's possible that only government-controlled oil companies with different objectives, like energy security, are going to be willing to invest in conventional oil. Getting back to the point I said before, I fear that we are all collectively being pushed out of conventional oil into LNG projects or into coal to liquids or something that is not conventional oil because tax rates are getting too high in several locations around the world. And there's another concern created by the bias in favor of new versus legacy investors. As partners, we think about what will it be like to have a large number of small players active in the environmentally sensitive North Slope. The costs associated with environmental protection are really high, and I know ConocoPhillips has very high standards on environmental protection, and as well as state and federal governments and local governments have the same standards. And this level of environmental sensitivity may be new to many of these players, so that's something that we worry about. I can move to the next slide. So now I want to make a case about why you should want us to stay, what we have to bring to the table to offer you. ConocoPhillips has been a long-term investor in Alaska, and we want to make the case for why our company, along with the other majors, should continue to have a significant role in the state. We have the size, we have the financial strength to carry out projects of any size. We have the skills to manage large and complex projects, and we have substantial experience in both developing and operating in the Arctic region. ConocoPhillips in particular has substantial experience in heavy oil production, both in Venezuela and Canada, and we have leading coking technology so we can process heavier crudes. We're also the second largest refiner in the United States, so we have lots of refineries that we can upgrade to bring more heavy crude in to process. And we have strong commercial acumen and access to markets, which allows us to design projects to maximize the full value of the resource. For example, ConocoPhillips is the second largest gas marketer in the United States. And we have strong risk management skills. And finally, we have a long-term investment horizon. This means that we invest year in and year out and won't leave when market conditions get tough. Next slide, please. And finally, the last point I wanted to make before turning it back to Brian is why we should be viewed as desirable investors because of our great investment capability. This chart is showing you the 3-year average total upstream spending in billions of dollars of the majors versus various independent petroleum companies. We can and would like to bring a lot of investment dollars into this state, provided the terms are competitive. The tax proposal as introduced is the upper bound of what we believe is reasonable given the totality of the deal. I thank you very much for your attention. I'm going to turn it right back to Brian to finish.
Before we move on to some concluding comments, I wanted to mention briefly that we have identified some suggested language changes to clarify and improve the bill. Among other things, these changes concern how eligible deductions and credits are identified and the value at the point of production and how that value at the point of production should be calculated. We are developing proposed language to reflect these changes and hope to offer that language to you shortly.
Can I interrupt you a minute?
Please.
I would hope that each of you would give us copies of your presentations.
And we will, Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
The written testimony, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we've got the PowerPoint, the written testimony.
I'd like to summarize several key messages from our discussion today. One, the proposed tax results in a more than doubling of the effective tax rate over the current system. In isolation, we would not view this change as reasonable, fair, or appropriate, particularly given the state's current budget surplus. However, as a foundation for oil and gas fiscal stability that facilitates future investment in Alaska, the balance proposed in this bill is something that ConocoPhillips will reluctantly support. Second, the North Slope has a huge heavy oil resource that's already significantly disadvantaged from a technology, quality, and cost perspective. Incentivizing this resource will be key to increasing production levels in Alaska. Third, a transition plan from the current production tax system to the new system is essential to ensure equitable treatment of our legacy investments. Many of these investments were associated with the development of marginal assets that were justified on the basis of the prior ELF system. Qualifying these legacy investments for deduction against the PPT is an essential part of the balance reflected in this bill. Finally, the tax rate associated with this bill pushes Alaska into a high-cost, high-tax bracket as compared to many other regimes around the world. This will affect the risk-reward balance that companies will evaluate before deciding to invest here. Before you accept the rate reflected in the governor's bill, you must first be comfortable with the potential risks of future investment at such a high rate imposing. I'd like to reiterate that Alaska and ConocoPhillips are aligned as partners on many very important goals: increasing investment in Alaska, increasing Alaska's oil and gas production, increasing Alaska's competitiveness, developing long-term relationships with proven partners for long-term mutual benefit. In closing, many factors have to be considered by a government in choosing the appropriate tax rate for an industry as complex as the oil and gas industry. Cost structure, including distance to market, prospectivity, potential field size, reservoir quality, regulatory constraints, and the desired level of investment are perhaps but a few of the factors that need to be considered. Today, Alaska is challenged in each of these areas, and the fiscal regime needs to recognize this. Thank you for considering our views.
Now, questions? I'll start off with one. You don't have to ask me if you don't want it. ConocoPhillips was the first company of the three, well, big three, to sign I don't think it was a contract, but an understanding with the governor that you accepted certain terms on the gas pipeline. At the time you signed that, was the PPT being discussed, or had it been requested of the governor that he do a PPT, or was that after the date that you signed that agreement?
Chairman Wagner, in response to your question, we had discussed the structure of the PPT prior to that date. Those discussions started as early as last July. I think the state's indicated, and we definitely agree, that it is typical for a new administration or an administration to approach potential taxpayers about a change in the tax system. But yes, we talked about that structure previously and about different rates prior to the point, I believe that was in October, when our negotiations on the gas fiscal contract reached a point where ConocoPhillips found those base terms were acceptable and we were ready to announce that.
Second question. We've talked a lot about PPT and the potential tax increase, but I'd like to talk a little bit about the ELF. We've had hearings in years past on ELF bills. I think we've all pretty well known that ELF was either broken or going to be broken at some time. And you mean you didn't take that into account when you invested? I'm talking about the clawback or the kickback or what did you call it?
Transitional investment expenditure.
Additional investment expenditure. Well, everybody's got a different twist to this thing, I guess. But didn't you, as a corporation, at least consider the fact that there may be some discussion in the legislature in the near future about either fixing ELF or an elimination of ELF and going to a different tax system?
Senator Wagner.
Don't speak into the water bottle. Mike's over there. I'm sorry, Brian, go ahead.
Our investment analysis, no, would not typically look for a change in a tax regime here in Alaska. There's no doubt, when we look at projects around the world, some of the countries we invest in, definitely we need to consider political risk, we need to consider the very real possibility of tax change. But no, I can't say that if we go back and look at our investments and the analyses that were done, that we planned on a dramatically different tax structure, especially not a doubling of the production tax rate. You know, definitely we look at all our projects, we build in our royalty rate, we build in state corporate income tax, production property, et cetera. But no, I don't know that we would plan on an increase in our production tax.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to interrupt your flow, but I mean, in both
well,
the key, okay, in both the key messages and just now, Darren, you said a doubling, and it's only a doubling if gas, if the price of oil stays at $60 a barrel, isn't that correct? It's not a doubling if it's $40 a barrel. It's certainly a loss to the state if it's less than $27 a barrel. So could you? I just appreciate it when you say a doubling. If you would clarify what you're talking about.
Chairman Wagner, Senator Elton, I apologize. You're correct. That doubling is at current prices. It is not at all price levels. It would be less than that at lower prices. Right.
Senator Dyson.
And when I asked the question earlier, it's only a 6 or 7% change from government's total take now. Correct?
Senator Wagner, Chairman Dyson, or Chairman Wagner, Senator Dyson, that is correct.
And at least some of that may be offset by the credits?
No, Chairman Wagner, the credits are built into that analysis, tax credits and investment. So that's an all-in effective rate.
So you were able to figure into that how much you're going to invest in exploration and development in Alaska when you made that chart?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Dyson, yes, we built in our projections, both for ourselves and for the industry.
It's fascinating when we all have difficulty predicting oil prices, but you're able to predict the investments for not only yourselves but the industry.
Chairman Wagner, Senator Dyson, we felt it was necessary to make an estimate and show what we feel is a dramatic impact in terms of directionally where the state of Alaska is moving on its overall tax regime. So yes, we made our best estimate.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Terrio.
Just a couple. I went down to get a copy of Senate Bill 185 to look at the tax credit mechanism and the ability to sell the tax credit. And so I just got a couple questions. Do you currently purchase credits under the existing system in the state of Alaska?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Terrio, I'm not aware of the fact that we do. So I can't answer that. I'm not sure that we do that.
Okay. If we could find out, somebody can just give me a call at my office. I'm curious on whether you do, if it's information that we can have on what you pay for $100 worth of credit. I talked to a consultant the other day, and you know, we just thinking about the benefit that we think will flow through to some of the smaller players, but in selling the credits, we expect that there's no, you wouldn't buy them if you had to pay dollar for dollar because there'd be no benefit. And I'm just wondering, you know, if it's advisable for the state to have some limits on what you pay for them. The consultant advised, no, he said, let the free market set that rate. And so I'm curious, under the current system, what kind of economy has built up as far as the buying and selling of those credits in the state?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Terrio, for me, I'm not sure I understand. I appreciate the question, but at the same time, that credit system and the tradability of those credits is structured, I believe, for the benefit of the state. Because the alternative is to simply write those producers a check. And I believe the state actually structures the system with credits such that in a scenario where prices are low, they don't have to cut those checks. Rather, those credits remain out there. But I think it actually works to the benefit of the state, and that's why it's structured that way. And yes, I guess I would have the same view that you should allow the market, the free market system, to work and value those credits as appropriate.
And Secretary,
I think you're right. It is structured to be beneficial to the state. There's some leakage though in that as far as the value, and I'm just wondering in that market dynamic, how much of that value is leaked out. So, whatever information is available from your company. Again, somebody can just stop by my office.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, Senator Stevens.
Sorry, thank you. I was reading something. Can we go back to slide 19, please? Granted, this was in a Wood Mackenzie study from 2004 with a 10-year period in there. And again, I find this fascinating that Alaska is at the, no matter what we do, we're in the high cost portion of production on a global scale. Now, I'm going to make the assumption, and I hope that you're the economist, you can verify the assumption, that the tax credits are going to move Alaska left on the vertical, I mean, left on the horizontal scale. And that, in terms of, if the, why hasn't the PPT with the tax credit, where you have it there, where it's there now, why haven't we moved to the left to a lower tax structure when you incorporate in the tax credits?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's because the overall tax rate is higher, and that is more than offset the additional tax credits. In fact, maybe you can verify that's how this was calculated.
So this is another way to demonstrate that what we learned from Mr. Van Meers is, from Dr. Van Meers, is that the tax credit has low sensitivity, and the high sensitivity is in the tax rate.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's less sensitivity than the overall tax rate. Would you agree?
Correct.
I still can't fathom why we haven't moved down the cost structure with the tax incentive. So, but you have to.
Maybe you can give your example you gave earlier.
That's cost before government take.
That's definitely cost. He's wondering why we didn't move down the government take curve.
No, I'm not talking about the government take. I'm talking about on the vertical. And it says low cost, high cost.
That is just cost with no government take in it.
Right, but if you incorporate the tax credits,
we
still don't see a movement.
That's right, and we wouldn't put the tax credits in there. We would put it in the lower government take. That's how we would represent it on that chart.
But it should, if it had a significant impact, it should still move us down more towards the center.
Right. It should have moved you to a lower overall tax rate, but it's the increase in the absolute tax rate from 13% in ELF to 20% being what's proposed more than offsets the improvement in the tax credits.
Well, it's a 6% effective rate with ELF, Again, Mr. Chairman, to me this shows the insignificance of the tax credit in the overall scheme of things. In terms of impacting what we can do in Alaska to make it a more competitive region.
Mr. Chairman, if I just make a comment to kind of respond to the Senator's comments. I think the way to think about that is that the increased tax rate would raise that Alaska ELF higher than even that circle is.
Right.
The tax credits bring it back down a little bit. The other way to look at it might be the way you're suggesting is, you just have a tax increase, the rate increase, and you could say the tax credits lower your effective cost, and you might move it to the left a little bit. But what I would say is that in that case, you'd be higher up on that scale.
We'd be higher on the scale, but maybe further to the left.
Right, depending on where you accounted for it, and so cost or take.
And you are right, though.
I just want to move this. There we are. Sorry.
And Just one thing, it isn't a huge impact in your case. On the level of an independent, it may be a very large impact. There may be a different scenario entirely. Is that a fair statement?
Well, it affects it.
Yes.
I would say it probably affects the economics of each individual separately.
Yeah, but different.
But if I could switch to another
Senator
line
Stevens.
Of subjects, thank you. Some of us don't have enough time early in the morning, so we go to Standard & Poor's and pull off analyst recommendations. And one of the things that sort of highlights is that last year, the capital expenditures for the company was about $11.6 billion globally. Is that
sounds right.
And how much of that was in Alaska? Do you know?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Stevens, about $700
million. About $700 million. And then it says that for 06 budgeted, you have $10 billion approximately for capital investment.
Sounds right.
And how much do you have budgeted in Alaska, do you know?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Stevens, roughly the same number again.
The same number? So it's a fair statement to say that the investment in Alaska has been consistent about $700 billion, regardless of the percentage that it is on a global aspect?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Stevens, actually, as you look back, you know, our share, our investment over the last 5 years is closer to $2.5 billion, so on average $500 million a year. No, I can't say that we hold $700 million as our capital expenditure level year in and year out on a go-forward basis. It's dependent on the projects we see and the economics of the projects.
And if I might ask, Mr. Chairman, of the $700 million you have allocated for investment in 06, approximately how much of that is for exploration and how much is that for what would say would be maintenance, development, or?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Stevens, I'm probably going to get back to you on that number. It's in the neighborhood of $100 million, I believe.
For exploration?
Yeah. A little bit less than that, maybe.
If we could see, it'd be appreciated if you could get the breakout of exploration, development, or what you call production. Mm-hmm. Do you do that in your allocation, right? The three allocations, or do you only do two?
Several allocations.
Well, I know, but we speak in three languages here: exploration, development, and production, which is what we're all what we're trying to maintain into the future. And I'd just like to see how you, if it's public information.
Yeah, Chairman Wagner, Senator Stevens, that was exactly my response. Let me check and be sure what we can release publicly, and I'll provide it.
You know, finally, Mr. Chairman, I want to. Good staff people give you good information, and we found a comment from 1999 from the former chairman, who has the same last name of one of our representatives from Anchorage, and he said that what I'd like to do is read this to you, and then I'm going to ask you. It says when we look beyond 1999, now you remember what 1999 was? It was $12 oil. He says, the future of Alaska will be shaped on four factors: the availability of the resource base, our cost structure, oil price, and the state's fiscal and regulatory policies. The question I have to ask you is how would you rank those? Which is the four most important items? I personally, from a business side, would know how to rank them, but I would just question, I would say, where would you rank the number? Obviously, oil prices are variable, so that's really can't put that in the equation. Maybe I can give them a little bit of. And the question is,
give us the answer.
Senator Stevens, would you like to answer your own
question? No, I'm not give them the parameters of where I'd like to answer. Because the availability of the resource base is obviously. In the availability of the base, I think you've shown us that the availability of Alaska resource base doesn't compare in the global perspective, because most of the information we've been presented, Mr. Chairman, demonstrates to us that what we're really expecting to find in Alaska is between 50 to 100 million barrel field, occasionally maybe a 400 million barrel field, but the availability of the resource is not a comparison to Kazakhstan or to the deepwater Gulf of Mexico. And so when you put the availability of the resource for exploration, it doesn't compare with other areas of the world. And the cost structure, that piece right there shows us no matter what we do with our cost structure, we know where we'll be. And it hasn't changed since 1999, and I don't think it'll change in 2016. And the only thing that we can change is the state's fiscal regime. So when you're talking to us, you want to tell us that the most number one important thing is the thing that we can change.
But, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that I said that is really why we've stayed in Alaska all these years, because we viewed Alaska as having a stable fiscal regime. Maybe it's a higher tax structure than we would have liked, given the prospectivity, but it has been stable all these years, and that's why we found Alaska to be so attractive. And our people aren't getting shot at here either, so.
Yeah. We aren't having revolutions. We aren't having hurricanes. You know, there's lots of reasons, but.
It just seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that the one thing that has the flexibility for change is what is before us, and the flexibility to skew that one way or another off the global competitiveness is the tax rate and the credit rate. No matter what we do here in Juneau, we're not going to change the cost structure of the North Slope. No matter what we do in Juneau, we're not going to increase the probability of finding the next 500 million barrel field. What we do here is going to affect, if we look at the history of tax policy change in the state for the next 17 to 20 years, just based on what's been done in the past, not a question of whether it's being incorporated into some other contract. The change only occurs about every 17 to 25 years. That's because they were viewed as a stable regime. So I think that we just need to keep all those things into consideration when we talk about a significant change. And I view it as a significant change in terms of a rate that goes from 6%. And by the way, Senator Elton, the numbers that you're requesting are in the fiscal note at $40 a barrel. From the chart earlier that you asked about, they're provided in the fiscal note from Department of Revenue. They did a status quo of 60 and a 40.
I think what's missing is in the fiscal note is does it show the difference between what it is at ELF and what it is? I'm not sure. I'll check the fiscal note.
But that's the one. The one piece of that we have the ability to manipulate, and that's the rate, the fiscal regime. So I would answer my own question by telling you I think the number one issue is fiscal stability. Now that I'm done, Mr. Chairman, they'll probably shoot at me.
Are there any other questions, Senator Terrio?
Can you tell me what have you calculated with what we've got on the written page today to be the crossover point between the status quo and the new proposed system?
Yeah.
We've heard 26, 27 from the administration. I've heard from the company's perspective it's something different. And at the very least, it seems like we should be talking about what that crossover point really is and get to an agreement on that.
Chairman Wagner, Senator Terrio. Our estimate, again, under these premises, is if you look at it over a 20-year period, that crossover point is around $25.
Okay.
Again, the way that you read that line is short of $25, under $25, the taxpayer will prefer to be on this new PPT system. That is, our tax payments will be lower than they would under the old system.
What's the crossover point at 25-20?
Chairman Wagner, Senator Terrio, I do not have that number with me today.
Thank you.
Further questions? See no further questions. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Appreciate your time and your patience. Tomorrow we'll hear from ExxonMobil and British Petroleum. On Wednesday we'll hear from the Explorers and the Independents. And on Thursday, hopefully, the administration will be ready to come in on follow-up on requests for additional information from last week and also other questions that we're posing to them. So with that, it's
early.
10 after 5, and we'll adjourn.